So I'm going to be talking today about something called the skill analogy. It's also often called the craft analogy or the skill model of virtue. So at its most basic, this is just the idea that virtue is best thought of on the model of practical skills. My main question today, though, is going to be how exactly we should understand that claim. So how exactly is it that practical skills are supposed to be giving us insight into what virtue is? And the reason I'm going to be asking that question is that I think that the standard way of answering that question makes the skill analogy not all that interesting. So we're going to look at a few similarities, or like commonly agreed upon similarities between skill and virtue, and then we're going to look at a bunch of objections. And I think that as we standardly would think of the skill analogy, those objections are good objections, and so the ways in which skill and virtue are that similar, or the ways in which skill and virtue are similar, aren't that many, okay? So as I'm thinking about it, I think there are a lot of ways you might think of the skill analogy as interesting for thinking about virtue ethics, but the primary way I'm thinking about it is that skill is a quite earthly, kind of mundane thing, okay? So we think that it's, we're very capable of developing skills, therefore, if we think of virtue on the model of skills, then, well, we're not really so tempted to think of moral knowledge as something otherworldly or unattainable. Another reason, though, is that skills are still achievements, so it's not just something easy to come by. And so I think that the skill analogy is nice in keeping virtue in this sort of in-between state. So we have the skill analogy thanks to a lot of ancient Greek and Roman philosophers. For instance, the first quote at the top of your handout, we have Callicles teasing Socrates for always talking about skills when what they had set out to talk about was virtue. It's sometimes been taken that the implication here is that Socrates thinks that virtue just is a kind of skill. Or at least the Socrates of the early Platonic dialogues. Later we have Aristotle retorting that no, virtue isn't a kind of skill, it's just somewhat like a skill. And then later on again we have the Stoics seemingly agreeing with Socrates, saying that the virtue is a skill, and in particular it's the skill of living well. So jump ahead 2,000 years to now, this is a very spotty history of the idea, obviously. Jump ahead to now, and we have contemporary philosophers engaged in the same debate and roughly falling into the same sorts of camps. So we have those who think that virtue is a skill, and those who think that it's merely like skill, and they differ on the extent to which they think it's like skill. I'm going to be talking about six of the main objections for thinking that virtue is not a skill. So for six ways in which virtue is disanalogous to skill. And what I'm going to be suggesting is that each of these objections actually misunderstands the skill analogy. Okay, and then I'm going to be trying to say that, well, if we understand the skill analogy correctly, each of these objections fails, and the skill analogy looks a lot more promising than a lot of people have made it out to be. So in particular, the question that I'm going to be asking is, in the skill analogy, what is it that the virtuous human being is supposed to be analogous to? Right. The standard answer to this question, and the one that I think generates all the objections I'm going to be talking about, is that they think that the skill analogy says that the virtuous human being is meant to be analogous to what I'll call the merely skilled individual. So this merely skilled individual might be highly skilled. The problem is that even in being highly skilled, we have a bunch of objections, a lot of dissimilarities between skill and virtue that we'll get into. What I'm going to be suggesting instead is that in addition to skill, in addition to being a skilled individual, what the individual that's analogous to the virtuous human being is an occupant of a role of some kind. Okay, and I'm going to be getting into what that entails. So I'm going to be arguing that there's more to what I'm going to call the skill role occupant than there is to the mere skill possessor, and that it makes sense to distinguish between these two. So I take my argument just to rest on the possibility of making the distinction. Okay, so here's how the talk will go. I'm first going to run through three similarities between skill and virtue. I'm then going to get into the six objections. I'm going to try to convince you that they misunderstand the skill analogy. And then in the end, I'll return to the objections I started with to show how the reinterpretation of the skill analogy accounts for those objections. So you'll see that, yeah, on the back, I haven't filled in the final section. That's not an accident. I just figured it was a waste of ink to put the same objections that I have. So, also, if you wanted to write your own objections, that would be a good space for that. Okay. So we're on to section one, so some of the agreed upon similarities. So first, both ancient writers and contemporary writers generally agree that both skill and virtue involve practical knowledge somehow. So I say involve to leave open the possibility of two different views. One would be the view that, well, so for two reasons, one on the side of skill and one on the side of virtue. So on the side of virtue, I say it just involves practical knowledge to leave open both the Platonic view that virtue is a kind of knowledge and the Aristotelian view that it merely involves practical knowledge. On the skill side, there's also a contemporary debate as to whether skill is knowledge or skill merely involves knowledge. So I'm saying, yes, involves just to leave open and to recognize that there are some disagreements within this sort of agreement. All right, the second generally agreed upon similarity is that both skill and virtue are to some degree teachable. So the main point here is that both must be learned. I say that they're to some degree teachable just to convey the fairly obvious point that sometimes teaching fails. So sometimes when you try to teach someone how to play golf, they don't actually succeed to learn how to play golf. Sometimes when you teach someone to be virtuous, they don't turn out virtuous. The third generally agreed upon similarity is that both acquiring and maintaining skill requires practice. So here we typically meet the fairly well-known Aristotelian line that in order to become just, we must do just things. In order to become musical or skilled in some other way, we must do musical things or otherwise skilled things. Of course, immediately after saying this, he also says, what is your second quote on the handout? That again, though, the case of the skills is anyway not the same as the virtues. So we'll get into those objections now. So actually, before I get into the six objections, I want to mention two objections that you might have in mind that I'm not going to talk about. So the first is the objection that whereas there are no moral experts, there are experts in various skills. I think that's an interesting objection. I think that what I'm going to say connects up with that a bit, but I don't think it entails one view or the other, so I'm not going to try to say that it does. The second is, for some people at least related, is the idea that whereas an action can be skilled, even if you can't justify it, an action can't be virtuous if you can't explain why it was virtuous. So obviously this is not everyone holds that view, but it's like a commonly made objection to the skill analogy, but I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, so on to the objections that I am going to talk about. Three of these objections, the first three, come from the Nicomachean Ethics. They're objections that Aristotle makes. And the second three are objections that contemporary philosophers make. However, they're all quite clearly intertwined. So I think, for instance, that from character objection, voluntary mistakes objection, capacity disposition objection, and the no vice analog objection are all somehow the same kind of objection. They all have to do somehow with the same issue. And then I also think that the action production objection and the no bad ends objection are quite close related as well. However, they're at least at first glance distinct, so I'm just going to treat them as distinct and not really worry about how distinct they are. Okay, so the first objection is what I'm calling the action-production objection. And the action-production distinction in Aristotle's studies is fairly contentious one, I think. I'm just going to essentially say what I'm going to take that distinction to be, and therefore what I take the objection to be. And if anyone wants to challenge that, I will do my best to defend it in Q&A. Okay, so Aristotle says that whereas the virtuous person chooses virtuous action for its own sake, the skilled person chooses skilled action for what it produces. One of the ways in which he's kind of confusing on this, he goes back and forth a bit between whether these two are necessarily distinct or whether action, sorry, whether production can be a kind of action, but I'm going to try to treat them distinctly. Okay, so I'm going to understand action for the sake of action or action for its own sake as non-instrumental action. Okay. When you act for its own sake, it's the action itself that's seen as valuable, not some further end. Acting for the sake of production, on the other hand, is acting for instrumental reasons. So when one acts for the sake of production, the action itself is seen as a means to something else that's seen as valuable. So Aristotle says that virtuous action then is non-instrumental, whereas skilled action at least can be, sometimes he says it can only be, I'm going to say it just can be, instrumental. Thus he concludes that virtue isn't kind of skill. Okay, on to the firm character objection. The firm character objection says that in order to be acting virtuously, one must act from a firm character, whereas one can be acting skillfully even if one doesn't act from a firm character. So what is a firm character? I'm going to essentially define it by way of quoting Aristotle as he's introducing the idea that virtue requires a firm character. Okay. So he says that the truly wise and good person bears all the fortunes of life with dignity and always does the noblest thing in the circumstances. He is not shifted easily and not by ordinary misfortunes but by many grave ones. Okay, so the point, I take it, of having a firm character is just that, or sorry, of saying that the virtuous person must have a firm character is that it takes a lot for them to start acting unvirtuously. Okay, so Aristotle doesn't think it's impossible that a virtuous person would become unvirtuous, but it'll take quite a bit. Okay. However, in the case of skill, it seems fairly obvious that, for instance, if we have an emergency room doctor who's quite skilled, that doctor might give up on exercising that skill just because the hours are unfavorable or something like that. That doesn't mean that the doctor isn't really skilled at doing what the doctor does. Okay, thus, again, virtue is not a skill. Next is the voluntary mistakes objection, again from the Nicomachean Ethics, but it's perhaps the most famous because of Philippa Foot. She puts it much more clearly than Aristotle does. She says that whereas virtue is impugned by involuntary mistakes, skill is not. So if I lie, whether I do so intentionally or not, that doesn't make any difference as to whether it's virtuous of me or not. Whereas in regard to skill, say that I have the ability to shoot a bow and arrow very well. If I intentionally miss the target, that doesn't mean that I'm not skilled, insofar as I did so intentionally. Okay. Thus, she concludes that virtue is not a kind of skill. Okay. Next, the first of the contemporary objections is the capacity disposition objection. It is the objection that whereas virtue is a disposition to act well, skill is a mere capacity to act well. So, in some sense, even though we've agreed that both skill and virtue require practice, which you would think would require a disposition to exercise the skill or the virtue, there's a sense in which the skilled individual can be skilled even if they no longer have any disposition to exercise it. Okay. So perhaps they won't maintain it forever, but at least there's going to be, it seems like a conceptual possibility or a possibility in a certain moment that they have the skill and yet they don't have any disposition to exercise and they're not going to anymore. next is the no vice analog objection. So this is the objection that whereas the contrary of virtue is vice, skill's contrary is something like unskilled, which is not analogous to vice. So why is it not analogous to vice? As I'm understanding it, and this is why I'm understanding it as connected to the capacity disposition objection, vice is still a positive disposition to do something. It's just a positive disposition to act badly. Okay. Whereas to be unskilled is either to lack a capacity completely, or else to have a capacity to do something only badly. Okay. So again, I think that this objection sort of rests on the prior one. And finally, we have the no bad ends objection. This is probably the most controversial of these objections. In particular, it assumes a fairly controversial view of virtue. It says that virtue cannot be used toward bad ends, but skill can be. So even though this is fairly controversial, I'm going to actually agree with it. I'm going to give you a short little argument for why I think you should agree with it. Okay, so first consider the case of skill. Imagine that I'm skilled at archery. I can use that skill, it seems, either for competing in archery competitions, which hopefully we can agree is a good end, or at least not a bad end. Or else I can use that skill to go around the world ridding it of some beautiful exotic bird. Hopefully we can also agree that that would be a bad end. In both cases, it seems I'm equally skilled, perhaps even more skilled in the case where I'm going around killing the birds, depending on how like fast and small they are. Okay. In the case of virtue, however, consider these other examples. So in one, I stand up to white supremacists who are harassing an immigrant family. In the second, I stand up to police while I myself am robbing that family. Okay. So the question is, can I be virtuous in both? Those who disagree with the no bad ends objection, I think, will say something like, well, you're showing courage in both. My response to this in favor of the no bad ends objection is to say that, okay, I'm happy to say that I'm courageous in both, but if that's the case, then courage isn't always a virtue. Or else, if they want to say, no, courage is always a virtue, then I say, well, then I'm not going to call that virtue. Or sorry, I'm not going to call that courage. Okay. So either way, I'm happy with the no bad ends objection, despite the controversy. So as you perhaps could tell, maybe not. If not, then saying it now. I essentially agree with all of these objections. I think that they're right about virtue, and I think that they're right about skill. And yet, I think that they get the skill analogy wrong. So now the task is to say why they get the skill analogy wrong, even though they get it right about skill. Okay, so now on to section three. So again, I think that they assume that, according to the skill analogy, the virtuous human being is analogous to the merely, though perhaps highly skilled individual. So for instance, the person merely good or very good at making shoes or treating illnesses or playing tennis, for instance. Okay. I'm going to argue instead that the skill analogy intends that the virtuous human being is analogous to the good occupant of a skill role. So in ordinary language, I want to make the distinction as the distinction between these other sorts of abilities and then the good cobbler, the good doctor, or the good tennis player. All right. And so I'm going to try to make sense of this distinction, kind of at the same time, I'm going to be trying to say that this is the way that the skill analogy should be understood. So I recognize that there are various ways in which one might argue that the skill analogy should be understood one way rather than another, given the type of thing the skill analogy is. So given that we're sort of adopting it from ancient philosophers, we might think, well, the thing to do is just to look at the ancient philosophers and see what they say. I think that that's an interesting thing to do. Obviously, they disagree a fair amount with each other. I think that most interesting is that some of them seem to disagree with themselves within the same text. So I think that Aristotle is the paradigm example here, I think that you can probably, I think you can probably get the idea or something similar to the idea of a good skill role occupant out of the Nicomachean Ethics when he's making positive use of the skill analogy, and that then he reverts to talking about mere skill possession when he's giving the sorts of criticisms that I've just given. I'm not going to do that here. Instead, I'm going to focus on two other ways. So the second one, the second way you might go about arguing for a particular view of the skill analogy would be by arguing that contemporary defenders of it don't do a good enough job, and that the view that I prefer falls out of their mistakes. I'm going to do a little bit of that at the beginning, but then I'm going to primarily rely on this third way, which is just arguing that it makes for a better better analogy. So it's more true, and not only is it more true, it is a good interpretation of the claim that virtue is similar to skill, or sorry, that skill is similar, that virtue is similar to skill. Okay. So that's going to be the one I'm primarily going to rely on. Great. Okay. So I'm starting on to section four. So I'm starting with just a brief bit of an argument of someone named Matt Stichter, who writes a lot about skill and virtue. And I'm going to start with his response to the capacity disposition objection. So Stichter thinks that the capacity disposition objection only seems attractive because we only ever think of skilled performers as evaluable in terms of standards of performance. So in terms of how skilled they are or appear when they're performing. All right. He thinks that what we need to recognize in order to see that the skill analogy works and that the capacity disposition objection is a bad objection is that they're also evaluable in terms of their commitment to the practice concomitant with that skill. All right. So here is the sort of thing that he means. He gives the example of an emergency room doctor who refuses to perform surgery on someone just because she doesn't feel like it, a little lazy or something. He says that this doctor is a bad doctor, not because she lacks skill, but just because she's not committed to doing what the practice demands of her. So I think that this response is on the right track, and I'm going to make quite a bit of use of it. But I still think it's a bad response to the capacity disposition objection. So, for at least two reasons. So the first reason is that being evaluable in terms of commitment to a practice doesn't entail being positively evaluable in terms of commitment to a practice. So maybe we can say, or I do want to say, that being committed to a practice means having a disposition to act well and as concerns that practice. The problem is that simply being evaluable in terms of commitment, my commitment to a practice still leaves open the possibility that I'm just not committed to it. Okay, so, and therefore, leaves open the possibility that I don't, in fact, have a disposition to exercise my skill. The second problem is that Stichter's response assumes that all skilled possessors are valuable in terms of commitment, and I think that they're not. All right. So part of the problem here is that as he uses the phrase valuable in terms of commitment, what he means is criticizable if lacking commitment. Okay. So yes, sure, I could evaluate just about anyone in terms of their commitment, but that doesn't mean that I can criticize anyone who lacks commitment in a certain area of life. So, further, I just don't think that all skilled possessors are valuable in terms of their commitment. So as an example, we could think of a retired emergency room doctor. We can imagine that such a retired emergency room doctor still has the skills that she has always had as an emergency room doctor, and yet it seems she's not criticizable for not exercising those skills and for not being committed to doing so. Okay. I think that probably there are others that are perhaps a little bit more intuitive. So for instance, maybe many of us have the ability to play some sports. I'll rely on tennis as an example a fair amount. It doesn't seem like any of us is under an obligation to play tennis, right? Insofar as that's the case, I'm going to argue that we're mere skill possessors as opposed to skill role occupants.
Okay.
And I'm going to try to use these two criticisms of Stichter's view in order to suggest that's the case. So here is a first shot at defining skill role occupant such that it's distinct from skill possessor. So I say that to occupy a skill role is to be subject to the demands of the practice concomitant with that skill. So as an example, we can say tennis players are those who are subject to the demands of tennis. This way of doing it won't quite get us there, so we're going to need to make some amendments. Here is the main problem. Any skill possessor, insofar as they're engaged in the activity, is subject to the demands of the practice. So for instance, anyone who is playing tennis is subject to the rules of tennis, and in some sense is required to be committed to those rules. Okay. So we need something more. I think that we can get that something more by making two further amendments. First of all, skill role occupants are those who are not only under an obligation to abide by the demands of the practice while they're engaged in it, but also are just subject to demands to engage in it. So tennis players as skill role occupants, I think, are subject to demands to play tennis. If you don't play tennis, so for instance, to refer back to the capacity disposition objection, if you never play tennis, then you're just not a tennis player. So if your being able to play tennis is a mere capacity, then you just won't fit what I'm trying to say is a skill role occupant. Okay, so for instance, yes, again, the tennis player is not only subject to demands to follow the rules of tennis when playing, but they're under some kind of demand to actually play. Okay. Whereas mere skill possessors, and this is the second point, they can play only for, so in virtue of not being subject to any demand of the practice to play tennis, they can only play tennis for what I want to think of as instrumental reasons. So they can play tennis to please a friend, or because they promised to, or because they're under contract to do so, or to blow off some steam, but I think that they can't play for the reason that they're a tennis player. All right. So on the skill role occupant side, on the other hand, I think that they can play tennis for the reason that they're a tennis player. And I think that when the practice demands that they play tennis, they ought to play tennis non-instrumentally. Okay. Excuse me. So I think that, yes, to be a skill role occupant then, as I want to think of it, is to be subject to the demands of the practice concomitant with your skill, including the demand to actually engage that skill, and to do so non-instrumentally. Right. I think that this sort of person, so the paradigm of the skill role occupant is the good tennis player, the good doctor, the one who plays tennis for the love of tennis, because you know this is what I do, I'm a tennis player. If you ask them why they play tennis, they say things like, you know, they're somewhat confused. I'm a tennis player, that's what I do. Whereas the mere skill possessors will say something like, oh, it's good for exercise, or something like that. Okay. Okay, so I think that this distinction is not only one that we can make sense of, I mean, I think it helps us make sense of, for instance, the retired emergency room doctor. Why is the retired emergency room doctor why do we not demand of the retired emergency room doctor that she continue to perform emergency surgeries? Well, because she may have the skill, but she no longer occupies the role. I'm not going to try to give an account of how you get in and out of roles, but we can talk about that in Q&A. I don't have any sort of worked out thought about how that happens. Okay. So, returning now to the objections, our conclusion. So I hope that in the case of most of these, it's fairly clear how the objections are met. That's one of the reasons why I didn't put anything there. So I think that's at least the case for the first five, that it's fairly obvious. I'll run through them quickly, and then I'll spend a little bit more time on the no bad ends objection, because it, again, I think will be the most controversial of the objections, or at least it will be most controversial that I've done what I needed to do in order to meet that objection. Okay, so as concerns the action production objection, I have hopefully shown that the good skill role occupant exercises her skill non-instrumentally. So first I said that only skill role occupants can exercise their skill non-instrumentally, and that the good skill role occupant does so. And I've said, hopefully you remember when I was introducing the action production objection, that that is how I was going to understand action for its own sake, is action that is non-instrumental. Okay. As concerns the firm character objection, I've said that the good skill role occupant is committed to the exercise of her skill, and it would seem to follow that the highly committed skill role occupant won't give up on doing so, even in the face of sort of struggle. So go back to the emergency room doctor who quits just because the hours are a bit tough. Again, we thought that doesn't impugn the doctor's skill, but in the case of the good emergency room doctor, in the sense of a good skill role occupant, it seems that as committed, they won't give up on exercising their skill very easily. So of course, Aristotle would agree that if the circumstances are quite difficult, so say the shifts are, I don't know what crazy, like 48-hour shifts or something, and you're not in, you don't have a little sleeping room to get rest in, then maybe it would be reasonable to give up on it or something. Or maybe even the good emergency room doctor would give up on it then. But it seems that, that the good skill occupant requires acting from a firm character. Next, as concerns the voluntary mistakes objection, it seems that voluntary mistakes do impugn the status of a good skill role occupant. So keep thinking of, well, actually, I like tennis here better. So think of the good tennis player. The good tennis player in the midst of a match doesn't intentionally hit the ball out of bounds. Okay, that impugns their status as a good tennis player. Again, they have skill, and it doesn't seem to impugn their skill, but it does impugn this other thing that I tried to point out. Next, the capacity disposition objection. So I've said that the good skill role occupant doesn't merely have the ability to act well, but she's disposed to act well. The good doctor, for instance, doesn't sit at home all their life. They go out and treat illnesses. Okay. Next, the no vice analog objection. So I've said that the good skill role occupant, I haven't said this, but the good skill role occupant clearly has a contrary, which is the bad skill role occupant. So of course, not every bad skill role occupant will have a positive disposition to act badly, unless you think of their intentionally flouting the demands that they go out and do something. But there will be a certain kind of bad skill role occupant who is disposed to act badly. Okay, so there's at least a piece of the contrary of good skill role occupant that will be analogous to the contrary of virtue. Okay, and finally we have the no bad ends objection. So again, this is the objection that whereas you can use skill to bad ends, you can't use virtue to bad ends. And again, I think that my answer here is going to be the most controversial. In fact, I'm going to try to avoid answering the question because I think it's an unfair question, but I'm going to justify my doing so, and hopefully that will count as responding to it. Okay. So I'm assuming, so throughout I've been more or less assuming a roughly Aristotelian view of the virtues. If we continue to do so, I think it's okay to assume that the good ends that virtue is thought necessarily to aim at is going to be what Aristotle calls life going well as a whole, the universal good, things like this, okay, which he says is the end of virtuous action. Okay, he identifies it with virtuous action. In that case, the question that the no bad ends objection puts on us is, can the good skill role occupant, sorry, does the skill good skill role occupant have life going well as a whole as her end? Okay. I think that we're tempted to answer no here. I want rather to resist answering. So I think that the question would be a good one if we were talking about something called the virtue analogy, where we were trying to think of skills as a kind of virtue, but we're not. We're thinking of virtues and whether virtue isn't a kind of skill. Therefore, it seems that skills or these skill roles don't need to have as their end the end of virtue. They just need to have an end for themselves. Okay. And I think that we've talked about those ends a little bit. So these would be ends like cobblery, medicine, or tennis playing. And the job, I've said, of the skill role occupant is to pursue those ends for their own sake. I think, hopefully, a positive result for the virtue ethicist is that this still leaves virtue with its job of essentially organizing all of our other practices and making them fit together, instead of, which is not the job of virtue, to sort of commandeer all the ends and make them the ends of virtue, okay? So I think that the skill analogy is safe from this objection too. And that's it, thanks.